Saunders, real number 6. Now, I should like to start examining the kind of work you did on active service in France from the beginning of 1915. And could we start off by making it clear that, in fact, you had not one job while you were there, but two?
Yes. My main job was engine fitter, or in other words, my full responsibility was the engine. But then there was, we worked so closely together with the pilots that the pilot of the machine you were working on very often took you up for a flight to keep buying the friendship, and because he was knew he was dependent on you. And as I previously said, we looked on our aircraft like the cavalryman looked on his horse, and we expected the pilot to bring back the aircraft to us, and he expected us to send the aircraft up to him, so that we gradually got that we worked together. And as a reward for our work, he would take us up and very often and let us be observer or gunner, as the case might be.
And this flying aspect of your work, in fact, became a regular part of it later on, didn't it?
Well, it became a regular part in as much as this, that your pilot and you began to understand one another. And there was a sort of, what will I say, not a tic-tac way of communicating, but there was some sort of a way of communicating with each other in the aircraft, sensing one another, that if you wanted him to... for instance, have a look at something on your port bow or your starboard bow, you were able to convey that to him without actually saying it to him. And he was able to convey to you through somewhere or other that what he was going to do to a great extent. So he became absolutely a team and relying on one another.
Now, can we concentrate for a moment just on the engine fitter side of your duties, and could you tell me about the regular routine that developed as far as your work on engines was concerned?
Yes, well, I spent most of my time, number one, on rotary engines, and my job was to look after that engine, see that the fuel and everything was all right before she left, and everything in working order, everything properly adjusted. And when I thought that that engine had done sufficiently long running, I just say to the pilot, I'll change this engine when you come down. So immediately the flight was over, I got to and took this engine out, and the esprit de corps was so great in the flight and in the squadron that anybody else in the flight who didn't happen to be doing anything, he'd come and we'd work together and take it out.
Do I take it that there were two engines for each aircraft?
Oh no, there was an engine for each aircraft, and there were two spare engines in the back of the hangar.
I see.
Well, now we took this engine out of this aircraft, and we put it at the back of the hangar and took one from there and put it back in the aircraft. And then as soon as that was all installed properly and tried, then we all got together, any engine fitters and sometimes a rigger if we weren't busy, we'd pull that engine to pieces, check it up, examine it, and any part that we thought wanted renewing, we'd renew it, because we had the spares.
And that then became one of the two spare engines for the flight.
That was one of the two spare engines then, you see. Mm. And
that was the major operation, presumably a complete engine change. Were there other less major?
Well, we had to change the plugs, the sparking plugs, every time the aircraft came down, because these aircraft, engines, as I previously said, for lubricant, they had pure castor oil. And the castor oil and the petrol was mixed in the crankcase, which used to revolve. with the result that when she fired and the exhaust valve opened, a lot of castor oil came, pure castor oil, unburnt, came out along with the exhaust. And this got scattered all around the outside of the machine, the engine, and over some of the machine. Well, the plugs, of course, if we left them in, they would be just oiled up when we went to start again. So the main job was, first of all, you pushed open the exhaust valve of each in turn of each cylinder, and you let all the surplus oil run out onto the grass and didn't bother about anything else. Then we took out the plugs, put them to one side, thoroughly cleaned down the engine and checked the ignition, things like that, and finally put a new set of plugs in and new leads. The leads, by the way, in those rotary engines consisted of one strand of, I think it was about 20-gauge brass wire, and it was just twisted around the end of the plug, plug terminal, within a little groove in the terminal. There weren't any nuts on the plugs for these particular engines. And then we pass it through a hole on the distributor and just twist it around there, and that was the ignition leads. Well, everything, we had the engine, then at the rigger, he had a job of washing all the castor oil off the fabric when the aircraft came down. Well, we used to muck in and give them a hand with them.
How heavily were the aircraft used on active service? Did they get a lot of wear?
Well, they were usually up, provided the weather was all right. They usually did about perhaps 6 hours in 3 days as a rule. And the life of them depended on what really happened to them. I mean, say, very, very often we had an aircraft which was officially credited with about 120 hours flying times. But the only thing that had actually done that 120 hours would be the number on the rudder. And that had been renewed several times, because it was quite a common thing to renew a plane or parts of a plane very, very often after about, well, an engine usually ran about 20 to 30 hours before it needed an overhaul. And, of course, there'd be a different engine in the same aircraft, four or five different engines in it during its lifetime. Well, then the fabric might be badly patched or badly damaged with the oil and petrol, and perhaps that had been recovered three or four times. And then a launch run might have been shot away, in which case that would have been replaced. So that you couldn't really say how long an aircraft lasted, but we still painted the same number on the aircraft after we'd done a big job on it.
Can I put this to you? Did you experience any problems when you're on active service in France that caused you particular difficulty, problems which you may not have expected, as regards the engine and the...
Well, one of the troubles we found with the Lerone engine, that superseded the Gnome. The Gnome engine had its inlet valve in the top of the piston, and the exhaust valve was mechanically operated. The inlet valve was automatically operated by the suction of the piston going down, open it and letting in fuel, and then closing on the compression and firing. Well, the Lerone had a mechanically operated inlet valve and a mechanically operated exhaust valve with an induction pipe going from the cylinder head to the crankcase. Well, this was a copper pipe which acted as an induction pipe. And at first we found that these were breaking the flanges off. And we came to the conclusion eventually that it was because the expansion of the cylinder and the expansion of the copper in the pipe weren't the same, so the flange came off. Well, this was overcome by splitting the, making the pipe instead of in one piece, the induction pipe in one piece, it was split in the middle and a rubber joint put on there. That is, there was a hollow cut in one pipe and a rubber gasket put in, and then the rubber, the rest of the copper pipe was forced over that rubber so as to form a gas-tight joint. Well, of course, this allowed for expansion, and we had no further trouble with that. But then another trouble we had with the Liron when we got it out first, and we had the whole time, really, I was with them, was the cracking of the piston bosses, because there were white metal bearings in the small ends, and we found that after a while the bosses used to crack. So we often pulled off a cylinder and had a look at it just for that, and then if we found the sign of a crack in the little end, well, we just replaced the engine and put new ones in. And
did you experience any other particular difficulties with the airplanes under active service conditions?
Well, of course, the where we were landing, the fields we were landing in, we called them airdromes, they were just ordinary fields, and naturally they had some bumps in them here and there. Well, you happen to touch one of these bumps when you were landing, you got a bumpy landing. And with the Morans in particular, we found the peculiar structure there of the axles. The axle was in two pieces, and it had a pin joining the two pieces together in the middle. And then, of course, the shock absorbers, they were out near the wheels. Well, through watching and points and one thing another like this, them landing, we noticed that when the wheels, it seems obvious now, when the wheels landed, touched down, they went back a little and the center came forward a little. It wasn't supposed to do this, but it did come back about an inch or so, with the result that the undercarriage collapsed. Well, we overcame this difficulty by putting a wire from this bolt in the centre of the axle up to a brace in the fuselage just near the pilot, behind the pilot's seat. And this took up the shock then when we landed, and we overcame it that way.
Mm. Did it cause many casualties before you sorted it out?
It didn't. It caused several undercarriages, but nobody was hurt over them.
Was this a fault which was peculiar to the Morane, or was it general to other aircraft?
No, that was peculiar to the Morane, because, as I said, the Morane axle was split in the middle and then connected with a pin, one pin in through two eyes, and the undercarriages in all those aircraft, the axle, there was the V part of the undercarriage coming down from the fuselage, and then the axle with the wheels on it rested on top of this V, and then it was bound round with a lot of this rubber, rubber.
Could you describe for me your impressions of the war in 1914 from an aero engine fitter's point of view?
Well, first of all, nobody, including the Germans, took the aircraft really seriously. It was more of a glorified hobby which somebody else was paying for us to enjoy. And I think we all looked on it that way. And from the fitter's point of view, it was simply a question of the pride we took in our job at the time, and we considered ourselves to be top-notchers, to be able to keep these aircraft engines going and do what we did with them. But from the air point of view, well, when you went up, you really, before you went up, you just regarded in the same way as if you were going out with a gun to do a bit of shooting in the at grouse or pigeon or something like that. And you didn't really take it, the game seriously at all. You thought it was just one big, long game. And the Huns, to a certain extent, they took it the same, because on many occasions, when you'd used up all your ammunition, you'd wave to your opponent whom you'd been trying to shoot down, and he'd trying to shoot you down, and you'd just wave to him and sort of say, well, I'll see you tomorrow.
Did you find under active service conditions that any modifications to the airplanes which you were working with were necessary in order to get the best out of them?
Well, we came to the conclusion in some cases that we could improve on them a little. And as there was no paperwork or no instructions or anything given with the aircraft or engines, we could do as we liked with them, more or less. You'd just, mechanic would say to the pilot, oh, when you come down, I'll think if I did so and so, and it had improved, and you did. For instance, with the Avros. Where are you going? The Avro had a number of wires, bracing wires, going between the planes. These wires were known as some of them as landing wires. They took the strain of the wings when the aircraft landed, and then others of them were known as flying wires. These took the strain when the aircraft was actually flying, and so prevented the wings from collapsing. Well, these wires were made of stout steel wire, and naturally, they started a lot of resistance, offered a lot of resistance to the, as the aircraft was going. So what we thought, if we streamlined these wires, that is, made the wires as tapered at the rear, at the back, that they wouldn't cause so much drag on the wires. So we got the carpenter to make us some streamlined shapes out of some spruce wood, and this we taped along these wires at the back, with the result that when the aircraft was going along, the air struck the front of these wires and then just more or less glided off the back of them instead of dragging them back. And much to our surprise, this put about 7 miles an hour onto the aircraft, just this simple thing.